Presenting Ron Reinikainen.
Reinikainen, por favor. It's nice. Yeah, this group is good because it's very multicultural, if we can use that expression. In fact, this morning I learned a new word from our member, Tuk Tahoma, and it is, see if I got this right. I had to write it down. Hokke? Hokkahe, hokkahe. So I said, okay, hokkahe. Hokkahe. We go on attack. Anyway, my name is Reinikainen, and I work here at the library for a little while longer. I'm a catalog and reference librarian here. And my interest was in the old Spanish trail was sparked about 3 years ago when I got a phone call here at the library from a fellow in California. His name is Vincent Trujillo, and he was calling from Santa Rosa, California. And he says, you know, my family tells us that we actually originally came from New Mexico. Is there something to that? And I said, well, I'll look into it. And sure enough, in fact, one of the names he gave me was Lorenzo Trujillo, who was a very important person in the New Mexico colonization of Southern California in an area. This is Southern California. Santa Rosa, of course, is in Northern California, north of San Francisco. But the colonies were in a place called Agua Mansa, Calm Waters, and San Salvador. They were on either side of the river there. And this is near San Bernardino in Riverside, California. Anyway, I did look into it, and I sent back an email to him, and I guess he was satisfied with the information that he got. There is a chapter in Southern California of the Old Spanish Trail Association as well. In fact, I've done research here for a woman named Karen Cordova, who's become a friend from the southern part of California, who does genealogical research. Her family came from up by Walsenburg in southern Colorado. Anyway, this is just fascinating, and I get to work with it. I get to work with the materials that we have here in the library, plus other items from the internet or bibliographies and this and that. What I want to do today is talk about, these are materials that we do have here in the library. There are only a few that are directly about the Old Spanish Trail itself, or, you know, as the subject. But there are many others in where it plays a role. Because the Old Spanish Trail was used first of all, by the native people that lived there, the Indians. Either not all, perhaps all the way, but in segments of the trail. Say from Mojave, there was a fellow named Padre Garces who in 1776 or thereabouts wound up in Yuma, Arizona is, and he went to the coast to decide, and he wanted to find a way to get to the ocean, which he did. And they put him down as the discoverer of it, of the trail to the Pacific from the deserts of Arizona. Well, he said, that's not true. He said, on the way over there, I met Mojave people who were returning to their villages because they had been over there to get shells. So that's, and often in at least the newer works here, they often repeat that the first people, the fur traders, or Armijo or Dominguez Escalante, were not the originators of the trail. Those people who lived along it, especially going from here, the Utes, and on into the Paiutes and the Mojave people, they had ways of getting back and forth. As we know, when they talk about Chaco Canyon, the early part of it was, this was an isolated phenomenon. Well, they found out this was not an isolated outpost. It was connected to the whole thing, Casas Grandes, and they discovered at Chaco they discovered toucan feathers and such that could only have come from, you know, Mexico or Central America even. Anyway, let's go on to this. Book materials that I'll just briefly go through a little of them. I can't cover all of this, obviously, so it'll be a kind of an overview. And one of the more recent ones is called The Old Spanish Trail North Branch and Its Travelers. And this is, we're dwelling here pretty much on New Mexico or Colorado, southern Colorado, because this is our area of interest. And this is where the Hispanos played a big role, as well as the Indios. And, everybody else, too, sure. This is interesting because it's a collection of primary source material, diaries and records of travelers. And the North Branch comes from Santa Fe as the main point of departure, although Taos and Abiquiu were important as well. And the North Branch came pretty much north, as it implies, to where San Luis is, up to a place called Saguache. There were other trails that kind of combined here at Saguache. Why did they go up here when the direct route to California is west? Anybody have any ideas? Grand Canyon. Yeah, how the hell do you get across the Grand Canyon in 18th century? Well, Tuck can fly and his people can fly, but they knew how to do it. But, you know, the European-derived people, they tried. They tried, and there's a story to that, too. But they had to go up way north in order to cross the Colorado and Green Rivers, where it wasn't embedded in a deep canyon, but it was more shallow, and you could cross it. Dominguez and Escalante in 1776, who departed from Santa Fe, chose to go more or less this way, and they ran out of time because winter was setting in, and they didn't get to California. In fact, they had a hard time coming back because they had to cross the river where it is deep in a canyon, and it took them 10 days or 2 weeks just to cross it, and they ran out of food, but they had horses and mules. This is a common thing with these early travelers. They'd run out of food, and they were reduced to eating their animals. Well, at least they had food on the hoof, you might say, although some of them were, especially the Anglos, were kind of disgusted by the taste or whatever. Anyway, this is the first description in here, or report, is actually by a well-known man in New Mexico history named Don Diego de Vargas. What was de Vargas known for? Anybody? Santa Fe and the resettlement of New Mexico by the Spanish or Mexican and some of the native people from Mexico in 1692. That followed the Pueblo Revolt, right? Where did the Pueblo Revolt originate? Popey, who was from Oquehuingo. No, he wasn't from Taos. He was from Oquehuingo, as far as I know.
Santo Domingo?
Possibly. San Juan. Well, San Juan is Oquehuingo. No. But anyway, okay, this is 1694, and this is 2 years after the resettlement, shall we say, or reconquest. Was called the Reconquest until political correctness of 10 or 20 years ago changed it to resettlement. Diego de Vargas certainly wasn't going to California. Why is he included in this? Because he was an early traveler from Santa Fe up to Taos and up into Colorado, and he came back down the other side of the Rio Grande. In all, he covered about 200 miles, maybe, something like that. 260 miles, perhaps. It was in terms of leagues. A league is 2.6 miles. Anyway, he comes up to Taos, and what happens at Taos? The people are fearful. They hear the Spanish are coming again. Uh-oh, what do? They run up into the cañon. They got the hell out of there. They left, you know, they didn't, and they, de Vargas sent emissaries to negotiate with, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So they stayed there and waited the Spanish out. Well, the Spanish waited also until they got hungry and their food supplies were running low, and they sacked the pueblo of all the corn that was there, all of it. And then they proceeded north. So anyway, that's... I have to give credit to Kessler, Ron Kessler, who edited this collection, for including that. De Vargas called it an entrada and a campaign. Curious language. Entrada means entrance, but a campaign is usually used in military terms, right? And it was. He had an army with him. Now they were also allied with the Utes to some degree. The Utes are another case, because they, as we learned from Isabel Trujillo, or I did learn from her, that when she spoke here last month about Abiquiú and the Genízaro people, who were Hispanicized native people, I had assumed that they might have been Utes. They weren't Utes. The Utes helped the Españoles raid pueblos downstream, namely, so I think Santa Clara and possibly San Juan, at that time known as San Juan, Okeahuinga. Those were the people who became Genízaros. And of course, the term is very interesting, because it's from the Turkish Janissary. It's very ironic, because who were the Janissaries in Turkey? They were Christians. And of course, Turks were their Muslims. So the people that were captured in the countries to the north of Turkey, say in the Balkans, were Christians who were forced into being the Turks, the Sultan's armies. Yes, go ahead. Anybody else can...
It's just coming to mind, but everyone remembers, or perhaps remembers, Shakespeare's last play, The Tempest, where there's a character named Caliban.
Yeah.
Now, Caliban, and the reference to just the sound of the name, Taliban, you have the Middle East. But at the same time The Tempest was being written, you had the French and Indian Wars, where the French were trying to make inroads with the Iroquois and things like that. And so some of the English account of these original contacts made it back to Britain.
Right.
And a lot of the saying goes that maybe Shakespeare had those accounts in mind when he wrote about Caliban, but the name had to be probably Middle Eastern sounding to make the whole idea work. And so you have the Genízaros thing going in one way, the Turks and the Europeans.
I think Caliban was supposedly from the Caribbean, wasn't he, or something?
The name, though, fits. It's right. Just interesting how this all mixes up.
It does. And, you know, we always think of, say, 400 or 500 years ago as being, you know, isolated. That was, you know, globalization, which is, you know, such a hot word now, going on since, you know, pretty much the end of the Middle Ages, you know, with the Renaissance and everything. Other works in here are very illuminating. Also, we have one about by Pike, Zebulon Pike. We don't need to go through that, because he's pretty well known here. But a fellow named George Frederick Ruxton, who was a very interesting young person, a Scots guy from Britain, decided he didn't want to go into his family's mercantile business or something. He took off, and he was really a wonderful adventurer. And he got up to New Mexico from Mexico, and he decided he wanted to see how the mountain men lived. And unfortunately, he took off like in the winter, and he wound up in horrific situations where, you know, there was so much snow that they'd get stuck and they ran out of food. And fortunately, they'd find people that could take them in. And he wound up in, I think, a Mexican household, where they were kind of leery of him, and until he told them that he was from Britain. And they said, oh, okay, if you're not an American, come on in. Well, that sort of, you know, epitomizes what the sentiment was after the occupation of New Mexico, which in laundered history makes it sound, you know, enlightening and all that. But it was pretty awful in a lot of places. And, of course, we'll have somebody speaking about I'm not sure if the revolt of 47, we've had lectures on that, of course, here. And we see the remnant of that attack, brutal attack on Taos Pueblo, because the Pueblo people kept the church in its state. We realized that was 160 years ago or so, or more. Same place. Sure, go ahead. Anybody can join in.
I'm not quite sure that this is true, so I may be just passing on a rumor. But I've heard that Ruxton not only was an Englishman, but was suspected to be an English spy who was collecting intelligence in this area for the potential American invasion and what Britain's role might be.
Yeah, my reading is he was here after the U.S. Occupation.
Right.
The U.S. occupation bore some effect on the trail itself. Let's go back to what the trail was. We're often sometimes confused with the Santa Fe Trail, which was a wagon route from Missouri to Santa Fe and then down the El Camino Real to Chihuahua. Okay, the reason they could employ wagons and oxen on that road, or those roads, was that it was relatively flat. They didn't have to go through over mountains. This way is all mountains and deserts and, you know, rough. So they couldn't use wagons on this. It became a pack mule. And there's a good example in Old Spanish Trail by Leroy Hafen. He was perhaps the first serious historian to write on the trail. And it's a wonderful book, even though it's 50, 60 years old by now. And he quotes from Ruxton, actually, from a trip that he had in Mexico regarding the pack mules. The equipment of a pack mule, and again, Ms. Kuhlhoff from Santa Fe has sent along this. The equipment of a pack mule, mula de carga, consists first and foremost of the aparejo. The aparejo, I guess this, which is a square pad of stuffed leather, maybe this. An idea of the shape may be formed by taking a book and placing it saddle fashion on any object, like that, I guess, the leaves being equally divided. This is placed on the mule's back on a jerga, or saddle cloth, which under it a salea, raw sheepskin sawn by hand, which prevents the saddle chafing its back. The aparejo is then secured by a broad band, which is drawn so tight that the animal appears cut in two and groans and grunts most awfully under the operation. Ruxton was a wonderful writer, by the way, probably one of the best of these primary source materials. It is in to which a greenhorn seems unnecessary and cruel. It is in this, however, that the secret of packing a mule consists. The firmer the pack saddle, the more comfortably the mule travels and with less risk of being a matada, literally killed, but meaning chafed and cut. And he goes on to it and says they get the mules, and they have to do this every day. These journeys to California took maybe 40, 50 days. So every day or every night after they traveled, maybe 12, 15 miles only, they had to take the cargo off and let the mules graze, hopefully, if there was fodder around, and then repeat the process the next day. So this was a rigorous undertaking all the way around, not to speak of, you know, dangers, encountering other people or whatever. Anyway, this is kind of good. When the animal has something placed over his eyes, so he remains real calm. The cargador, the mayordomo of the pack, stands on the side, his assistant one side, his assistant on the other, hauling on the slack of the rope with his knee against the side of the mule for purchase. When the rope is taut, he cries, adios, and the packer, rejoining, vaya, makes fast the rope on the top of the carga and sings out, anda, and the mule trots off to her companions who feed round until all the mules are packed. So they had it down, of course, because they were doing it on a daily basis. And it's interesting that when you compare it with the Santa Fe Trail experience, that where they would have to unyoke the oxen. That was the power for the wagons that crossed the Santa Fe Trail, were these big oxen. And so they'd have to unyoke them. And the cry in the morning by the mayordomos would say, catch up or yoke up. And that, they all had their own kind of linguistic, their terms for these different operations. Anyway, I'm going to have to go through quickly on these. We do have the Journal of Dominguez Escalante, and this is their own journal from 1776 again. Kind of interesting that, of course, the Spanish were here since in New Mexico since 1592. The Hafen is very good as an overview. We have another old Spanish trail book that was done by the Department of the Interior about environmental impacts on some of the trail. One of my favorites is this one. Yes, sir.
Is it true that Charles V claimed Taos as a province of Spain in 1550?
Yeah, I believe so. Was it Carlos Quinto?
Charles V,
yeah. One of the cries, yeah. In Santa Fe durante fiestas is Viva Carlos Segundo. Yeah. Now I don't know what the difference is there.
I have a question. Okay, on this Camino Alto going Camino Real. Yeah. So which should be the main route going like southeast? Which is the main route?
Southeast,
you mentioned
that
place, you know, where they want to make those subdivisions. Is that a sub branch? But which was the main one?
Well, maybe Lloyd maybe has more information on that. Possibly.
Peter McInnes, and I have done a lot of research, especially him. And he is like my mentor. I honor you for all you shared with me. Could you answer that?
Certainly. There are two routes. I think they were used equally. The summer route was called the Camino Alto, the mountain route.
Yeah.
And that came up from Peñasco to Vallito and up Telephone Canyon. And then it came up over the top of Picari Saddle and down the Arroyo Miranda to Talpa. And from Talpa, it went over to Cañon. And from Cañon, it went over to the Taos Pueblo along what they call Spider Road. The river route, Camino Abajo, was the river route, and it was the winter route, and it paralleled the Rio Grande. And it came up from what used to be called La Jolla, and it's now called Balarde, and it went a little bit to the northeast and went to the town that was then called Embudo, which is now called Dixon, and went up from there to join. You had a choice. You could either go up the mountain route or you could go back along the river down to Rinconada and then up over what they called the Mine Trail above Pilar, and then came down at Pilar. And then you could go up pretty much following the route that the road New Mexico 68 follows today. Those were the two routes. And they were related to the time of the year. You had problems with both of them. In the winter, the snow made it very difficult to travel, and the ice, and dangerous also. And the river route was, at least you always had water, but the problem was rocks were constantly falling down on you.
Okay, like in ranchos, from ranches by the Catholic Church, going through El Camino Alto, going to Peñasco, what route would I take?
It would come up from the Ponce de Leon Hot Springs, along the Arroyo Miranda, uh-huh, and right up through the old Talpa Dump, and right through the town of Talpa, right by the old grade school, now the community center, and up what they called El Tros Road. El Tros. That was the mountain route. If you wanted to come up from the river route, you came up from what used to be called New Mexico 570, now closed because of a landslide in 1996, came over to Las Cordovas, and from Las Cordovas it followed the Rio Pueblo all the way to the Taos Pueblo.
See, the reason I tell you is that, see, I live in Ranchos by the St. Francis School,
yeah.
Camino de la Loma,
mm-hmm.
Where the old public school used to be,
yes.
Right there. That's where I live, and I've been having problems having speed bumps there. And I've heard talks, you know, indirectly, that they can't mess around with that road because it was part of the Camino Real. They put pavement mm-hmm. at one time, but ever since my kids were small, I've been wanting to put speed bumps, and I've got, you know, and then now my grandkids, mm-hmm. I filed 80 petitions, presented them to the commissioners, and nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard rumors indirectly that you can't mess around with it because it's part of a Camino.
Well, that's not exactly true. It was a, what it was a lateral. It was a connecting route.
So how much
between the upper
have?
And lower roads.
How much cloud does it have? No. So how come we can't have speed bumps there? Because right there where I live, you know, it's very straight, and the kids use that. They call it the Taos drag strip.
Right on.
Speed bumps are horrid. I don't like them. And I'm with you 100%.
You see, but the thing is, I have gone up at 3 o'clock in the morning to drink water, and I've seen guys doing 100 miles there. So what's more important, you know? Save somebody that, you know, they say that the ambulance go fast or whatever when somebody's hurting. So what's more important, you know? Once in a while you get somebody that's dying or somebody is gonna, can get kids that can, get, you know, might be run over and get killed. So
well,
what's more important, you know?
What's more important is people. History
right.
takes
more
second,
people,
takes,
right.
takes
the
second
little kids.
Fiddle.
Right. Well, that's an interesting observation, and of how these old trails still impact our lives. In fact, I have a question I'll ask you later about the old road. I remember years ago because we used to be able to go from the bridge that goes up to Carson across the Rio Grande, and then you could go up the dirt road and come up on top. You didn't have to go around through Pilar, right? And was that part of an earlier trail?
Yes, actually. It was the original Indian trail, and it was used by Kit Carson because right at the top of the rim, on the west rim,
uh-huh.
he had a corrales system.
Uh-huh.
And he kept horses there
right.
and other livestock, and that was his quarters.
Yeah, well, they had water there, of course. Another book that is of particular interest is In Search of the Spanish Trail, Santa Fe to Los Angeles, 1829-1848. We're talking actually the trail, the old Spanish trail only being in existence pretty much during the Mexican period of New Mexico history, which was, of course, 1821 to 1846, 25 years. And that's sometimes overlooked, that period of history in this, our state's history. Connotation Mexican possibly did, you know, was unwelcome to some Hispanos or whatever. Well, we don't have to go through that stuff, but I find it a very fascinating aspect of New Mexico history. In fact, I do have a favorite person in that period who was much maligned. His name was Manuel Armijo. He was the governor three separate times during that 25-year period. And of course, he's not. There's no biography existent of Manuel Armijo. Why is that? Well,
the rebellion of Rio Armijo.
That one reason. That's still a sore point. There was a memorial issued recently in the legislature. I think this session about that topic, and his role in it. Which he, as ex-governor at that time, he was out of office. Rounded up fellow ricos, what so-called ricos from the Rio Bajo, Rio Riva being up here, and Rio Bajo, you know, Albuquerque and Sur, and crushed the rebellion, which was centered at La Cañada by Española. And there was a Genicero Indian, who, well, Hispanicized Indian, named Jose Gonzalez, who was made governor of the province of New Mexico. Well, Armijo had him shot, and that's another sore point. But the main thing about Armijo is that he capitulated when General Kearney and the Army of the West came towards Santa Fe. Now, if you feel familiar with Santa Fe, just to the west of Santa Fe on I-25 is an area called Apache Canyon. It's a defile of, you know, on both sides the road has been cut through, but in its natural state it was the same pretty much. It was a formidable obstacle to anybody approaching the capital of the Department of Nuevo Mexico. By that time, it was an official Department of Mexico.
I understand he refused to fight. They paid him not to fight.
Well, yeah, this is the common conjecture, is that before they came to New Mexico, the Army of the West, which was mustered up in St. Louis area, and they were well equipped with arms, and they even had a cannon, I think, or two, were at Bent's Fort, and a Mexican spy was captured by them, and they didn't harm him. What they did was they showed the Mexican. They said, come and look and see what we have, and see if you're going to resist us. And they were a well-ordered army at that time, 1,000 or so men, including Mormons, by the way, who had caught on with them because they wanted to get the hell out of Illinois because of persecution. And they wanted to join their brethren in the West. And so they joined up with Kearney. It's fascinating because, of course, the Mormons, and you'll see in the video, the Mormons represent, the video was made in southern Utah, and it's primarily a musical work by the Symphony Orchestra of Southern Utah. So there, the Anglos represented in the film, probably Mormons. And there are more than one of them. There's a whole group of them. Whereas the Mexicans are represented by one figure and the Indians by one figure. And I don't know about the fur trappers, maybe by a couple. Anyway, we digress. Armijo was much maligned because he did capitulate and ran off to Mexico. He was put on trial for treason for not resisting the U.S. Army or the Army of the West when he got to Mexico. But he was exonerated. Why is that? Well, he didn't get the assistance that was supposed to come from Chihuahua. That's where the larger militia was. And they had started up here, but they had not got here yet. And the militia in New Mexico at that time was about 100 men garrisoned at Santa Fe and with offshoots at Abiquiu and Genicero Village, of course, serving as a buffer between the Utes and the Navajos and the Hispano people. But there was another buffer town called San Miguel del Valle, east of Santa Fe, which was another Genicero village. It's where I live now, around in that area, my permanent residence. Those people were probably, the Geniceros were probably Comanche people that became part of the community, Hispanic community. Anyway, he was put on trial for treason in Mexico, but they couldn't charge him. So he actually wound up back in New Mexico. And the reason I kind of tied to him, because he didn't come all the way back up to Albuquerque, I think because of his reputation, and he would have been derided. So he wound up in a place near Socorro, which is south of Albuquerque, where I owned a house in Lemitar for several years. So I feel kind of connected to this guy. So I'm doing a big dramatic work on him. But then I'm looking always for things about him. But he was much maligned by the Texans. See, he was a hero. My theme in my dramatic piece is, who were you, Governor Armijo? Héroe o cobarde? Were you a hero or were you a coward? And I guess he was both, in a way. You know, people are more than multi-dimensioned. He was a hero because the Texans, in 1841, sent a party from San Antonio, where mainly the Hispanic population was, to attempt to, they said it was a trading mission, but they wanted to extend Texas all the way to the Rio Grande, including, and take Santa Fe. Well, he met them east of, on the plains there. They had an awful time crossing the Staked Plains. They were ragged and disheveled and didn't have much food and stuff like that. And, you know, our mijo went out to meet him, and they said, oh, we're here as a trading expedition. And he got off his horse, and he grabbed one guy, and he said, you're dressed up in this military gear, and you got all your arms? You're telling me you're traitors? If you're traitors, we don't allow traitors to be armed when they come to Santa Fe, so you'll have to give us your arms. And they did. Well, they locked them up. They rounded them up, locked them up, marched them all the way to Mexico City, really, walking. The Texans learned their lesson, I think, from that. You know?
Is it true that before this incident, that he had already sold the Maxwell and Grant another?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, there was a reason for that, and that was because they knew the U.S. manifest destiny. You know, the U.S. was burgeoning, the population was going, the industry was growing, and they were moving westward. And so the Hispanos were very nervous here, because they could see it happening. They've benefited from the trade, the Santa Fe trade, including Armijo. At one point in this work that I'm doing, he goes, oh yeah, when the gringos do it, they're entrepreneurs or enterprising. When we Mexicans do it, they call us criminals or ladrones, you know? Think about that, yeah. So, anyway, yeah, multifaceted person, but he actually, they've come to realize that he was a pretty good administrator. And what it is, there's one section in one of these books, I'm not sure which one it is, but he lays out the rules, because during Mexican period as well as Spanish colonial, they just didn't take off, you know, and say, okay, we're going to California, we're going to trade this up. No, you had to go through the routes, official routes. You had to apply for the journey from the, you know, gobernador or whatever. And he laid out the rules, and he said, in part of it, he says, you're not to disturb or molest any of the native people who are friendly to us, who are willing to give us assistance or negotiate or trade with us or whatever, you know. And that implied that, you know, hostiles will be met. And of course, the hostiles, this route, this southern route was through Navajo country, right, and Hopi. Both the Hopi and Navajo were hostile to the colonials. Tuck might have more on that. But, okay, well, I'm going to have to wrap it up, but what happened to the old Spanish trail subsequently? Well, when Kearney's army came in 1846, their goal was not New Mexico. Their goal was California, because the gold fields had just been discovered and all that. That was the big prize. They had to go through New Mexico and take New Mexico in order to continue on. Well, Kearney divided his men. He left some garrison in Santa Fe. They made Fort Marcy up above the town, and army. But the others, including himself, came down south and went down, say, the El Camino Real, which more or less follows the Rio Grande, and then went west to where, you know, where Silver City is now, or Santa Rita, the gold field, the copper mines, and then onto the Gila River and down this route. That became the route subsequent to the old Spanish trail, or after 1848, say, as one of these books puts it. Because, yeah. Going back to this one, this is a nifty book because it traces the trail, unfortunately not the north branch, which is the main branch for us here in Taos and on into Colorado, but it traces it from Abiquiu and then northwest. The main route was to avoid some of the steeper canyons. 5 or 6 miles north of Abiquiu, they would turn west or northwest more. And they'd wind up in all around the San Juan River area and then down through there. This traces it both with maps and photographs and old, you know, prints like that and stuff like that of existing towns along the route. So there isn't one single motor route that goes along the trail, so it's like in parts. But it is nifty because you can go along and see what the land looks like. just a word about the land. In the video that I'm going to play is mainly a musical presentation by this orchestra with visuals that they contracted for, including a lot of aerial visuals and stuff like that. That kind of stands out because as we can see, this was a grinding, slow, torturous route, you know, plodding with mules and stuff, whereas now they're flying over these same routes, you know, like whoosh, like they do when they televise golf shots at some of those prestigious golf courses. Anyway, just one other note about it. The people are represented in a very, you know, look at it symbolic way. A big sombrero, he's got a poncho, and, you know, the boots that don't have dirt on them or anything. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So you look on it symbolically, the native people, maybe a little more verisimilitude in the costume, is represented by a woman, una sola. As I said, the Anglos are represented by a group, which again reflects on where the movie was made or the video was made. I think this is the first showing here in town. And the music is good. Anybody else have any questions? These books, I didn't get to a lot of stuff, including Juan Bautista de Anza, who was a governor here in New Mexico. He was a connector because he was in California. He was acknowledged as maybe the quote, discoverer of San Francisco. He's acknowledged probably to be the best of the colonial administrators here in New Mexico. We have some material on him. And we have books on Native people that were proximal to the route, including, of course, the Utes. A book called The Utes Must Go, American Expansion and the Removal of People. And there's a section in here called chapter one, I think it is, about their interrelations with the people from, like, in Abiquiu, which they did. The Utes actually did have a kind of a commercial relationship with the colonial Hispanos. Hispanos, historic leaders, is a good section on Anza in here. Here's Font's complete diary about the founding of San Francisco. Jicarilla Apaches, Hermanitos Comanchitos. Indo-Hispano rituals of captivity and redemption. Those of us who saw were here for the Trujillo presentation learned about some of that from here. Comanche Empire, which both Eloy and I believe Jerry acknowledge, is a recently published work by Pekka Hämäläinen, another Finno-American, I guess. Ure, chief of the Utes, he was actually he was partly from Abiquiu. He became the chief, the main chief of the Ute people. And of course, there's a town named after him up there. Indian Slave Trade in the Southwest, an older work by Bailey. Las Carneradas, about sheep trade in New Mexico, 1700 to 1860. There was a very good presentation a couple of weeks ago by the Taos Historical Society by a descendant of sheep raisers here. His name is Chavez. Maybe Peter knows him. Going on, the Mexican Frontier is an excellent work on the American Southwest under Mexico, 1821-1846. David Weber has written extensively on this topic. The Hispano Homeland, The Witches of Abiquiu. This has an excellent section on the Geniso people. This has to do with some kind of like a Salem witchcraft trials kind of thing that happened here in the early colonial period. Los Primeros Pobladores, Hispanic Americans of the Ute Frontier, another one. Cook, this is a good description of the conquest of New Mexico and California by one of Kearney's colleagues, and it describes establishing this other alternative route, which became used by, like say, I believe the Butterfield stage route and going along the southern part of New Mexico and Arizona on to California. Southwest expedition of Jedediah Smith. He was an early fur trader. I didn't dwell on that aspect of the trail itself, but they were some of the early earlier users of the trail and all the way to California, because they had a, what happened with the fur trade, they actually trapped out most of the good material by the 1840s. And so before that, they could take beaver pelts to California because they could trade them to China for, you know, in return for porcelain and all that stuff that sometimes wound up here in New Mexico. Anyway, they were an important element of and users of the trail. Ewing Young, Jedediah Smith, Ruxton, of course, he was a little different. He was more of an adventurer. The Taos Trappers, this is good work. The fur trade in the far southwest, 1540 to 1846. Of course, you know, we know about Taos as being the most important rendezvous in the southern Rockies. Anyway, and we have reenactments in October every year at Martinez Hacienda. There was a fellow named Mariano Medina. He didn't play a role too much in the trail, but he was a Colorado mountain man, and he was from New Mexico, I believe, originally. The fascinating thing about the Old Spanish Trail is that it brought together a lot of different people, really, that wouldn't have been encountered each other except for, you know, an interest in a route, a trade, this and that. So even though it was short-lived, for those of us who are up here in northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, Utah, Nevada, well, we have chapters all over, apparently. Mark Henderson came here to Taos from Las Vegas, Nevada, right? And there's a chapter there, yes. Right? Because that was on the trail. Las Vegas, which means meadows, right? Like our Las Vegas, probably at that time was more fertile. And I know they had water there. It was a watering place. Señor.
Yes, I've heard that people used to say, I'm going to Taos. But it didn't really have to be Taos. Could have been Mora, Union County, San Luis, or other counties.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Well, I don't know. You mean a greater Taos? Did you just say Taos? If you mean, by going to Taos, you mean all over the place? I don't know. I don't know. Anybody have observations about that? I don't know. If you're going to Mora, you say you're going to Mora, not, you know? Or Rainsville. Or what was the original name?
Llano del Coyote.
Llano del Coyote. Okay, I'm going to turn the film on, and or if anyone wants to take a break. The film runs about 40 minutes, and if anyone wants to, you know, take a break here, I'll put it on in a minute or two. Or if they're all ready, I'll just, okay? You want to look at the books? Sure. I forgot to say that the books will be on display in the main part of the library, along with the maps. And the New Mexico map on the other side. And we also have a map of Colorado showing the routes in relation to present-day highways and such. So, thank you.